In this part of the EMC module, we're going to be discussing the hardware that is used in networked embedded systems, or more specifically, wireless sensor nodes. And we're going to be focusing on the computational part of the hardware. And just to review where we've been, we talked about full custom hardware, we talked about field programmable hardware, and the most popular option right now, which is software programmable hardware. And these are called microcontroller units. A microcontroller unit, or MCU, has a number of resources that can be used for implementing the intelligence, if you will, that goes into a sensor. Resources are shown here. There's a central processing unit. There is memory for the program. There's memory for data. There are peripherals. And then there's power management hardware. All these resources are used to support the main functions that the sensor must perform. And there are essentially three main functions. The first one is, of course, it must sense. And in order to do that, it needs to compute, do computations, and control. It needs to control the transducers that are used to acquire the data, and if there are actuators, it also must control those actuators. The second thing a sensor node must do is communicate. And normally, communication also involves computation. And a simple example of that would be source coding or compression of the data that's sent out. And the final thing that a sensor node does, if it's not communicating or sensing, is to sleep or hibernate. And this, of course, is to save energy and as many of the resources on the chip as possible are turned off. Let's distinguish between a microprocessor or MPU found in today's computers and smart devices and a microcontroller that is found in wireless sensor networks and numerous other embedded systems. In terms of functionality, an MCU performs dedicated functions within a larger overall system. So it's not just a microprocessor. Because of that, it contains a number of resources that microprocessors don't have. Most importantly is a rich set of on-chip peripherals. And we'll talk about this more, but it includes things like analog to digital converters, counters, timers, general purpose inputs, outputs. Some even incorporate analog circuitry for signal processing. MCUs also incorporate on-chip two kinds of memory that microprocessors usually don't have. The first is on-chip program memory, and this is designed to be non-volatile, so the chip does not need to be reprogrammed every time it's powered up. And also, it has on-chip data memory, and this is usually random access memory, and it's normally volatile, so it does not survive a power outage. Let's draw a very basic block diagram of any computer, and this would include not only an MPU, but MCUs as well. We start out with a processor. We also need to have memory. This is where the program and data are stored. And we also need some way of communicating with the external world. And this is usually called input-output. Obviously, these things need to be connected, So we have an interconnection structure. And that is what we can use to connect these subsystems together. Here is a more detailed view of the processor block that we saw in the previous slide. And this is from the point of view of what we call computer organization. So this is the nuts and bolts of how a processor is built. And it has three main components: a control unit, a bus, and a data processing unit. And the control unit is basically all here to control the operation of the entire processor. Now, we see over on the right-hand side here the ALU, or arithmetic logic unit. And the ALU is important because it serves as a nice connection to what we call computer architecture. Or we think of it as the instruction set architecture. And the ALU, of course, is designed according to the target instruction set of the processor. So if we think about the instruction set architecture of a computer, it has three main components. One is the instruction set. What are the core basic instructions that the processor can implement? The second is the data path width. Is it an 8, 16, or 32-bit MCU? And third are the addressing modes. And this would include indirect addressing, indexed addressing, and indexed indirect addressing. And there are several other modes as well. So here we've looked at the structure of the processor from the computer organization point of view, and then used the ALU as a takeoff point to get to the instruction set architecture. I'm not going to get into the details of how the control unit works. You can look at most of this in review of either your microprocessors or computer systems classes. But remember that we have a couple very important blocks here. Number one is the program counter, which points to the executing instruction, or the instruction that will be executed shortly. And there's a fair amount of addressing logic to make sure that the processor can talk to external, but in our case, on-chip memories. If we start with the previous processor block diagram, it's useful to see what we would surround that processor core with to get a microcontroller unit. So here's a block diagram of a typical microcontroller unit. And we start out here with the core that we talked about in the last slide. And you can see there's a lot more to an MCU to just a core. First thing we want to talk about are the on-chip memories. So we have in this block diagram two types of memory. The two types of memory are normally dedicated to program and data. Although if you do have data that doesn't change, that can usually be stored in program memory. Here is the core again. And that's connected through a memory management unit to those two memories. The first is flash, and this is where the program memory is stored. In the case of this particular device, it's 64 kilobytes of flash memory. And over here is the data memory. And this is SRAM, or static RAM. And in this particular device, we have 4K of memory. If you don't have enough memory space on chip, then you need to go off chip and interface the MCU with an external memory. And there are several reasons you might need to do that. One is that you may not have enough code space, so you might want to store some code off chip. Another is data archival. You might use it to log system activity or the results of your data acquisition activities. And finally, you might want to use it to save system state. And this means that you want to save enough information about your running software so that if there is a power failure or a crash due to a software bug, on a hard reboot from power off, the system can recover itself. Now, there are three kinds of non-volatile memory: flash, FRAM, and MRAM. Flash is the most popular and the lowest cost, and it has two types: NOR flash and NAND flash. Now, NAND flash is very, very common. It's very good for data storage, and it's used in MP3 players and in USB drives. If you want to store programs, then you should use NOR memory because it allows for random access. An alternative to flash is FRAM. It has a much longer lifetime in terms of write cycles, so it's very popular in automobile applications where important electronic systems must last a decade or more. It also has very high speed, has good random access, and low power consumption. The problem is it's quite expensive, and therefore they aren't nearly as large as flash memories. A new technology on the scene is magnetoresistive RAM, and it's very interesting because it has no known wear out process, so at least in concept, it would last forever. It's also very high speed. Unfortunately, it's quite new, so it's still quite expensive, and MRAM chips still have pretty small memory capacity. Now we return to our block diagram of a microcontroller. And if you recall, we started out with the core and then identified the memories that were then connected to the core via memory management unit. Now we're going to move to what actually defines microcontrollers, and that is all the peripherals. And one of the things that strikes you about this block diagram is that we have something called a port configurator here and peripheral control registers. The port configurator maps your peripherals to physical pins on the chip. And you can see a number of peripherals here: timers, pulse width modulated outputs for motor control, here's a temperature sensor down here. All of these are in turn controlled by registers that can be written to by the core. Peripherals are on-chip devices that are what allow the microcontroller to interface with the physical world. And we can break down the peripherals into several categories. The first is sensing. And the simplest might be a comparator connected to an analog input. A generalization of that is an analog to digital converter. We also can have multiplexers, so multiple inputs can be interfaced with one peripheral, such as an A to D converter. Some MCUs have what are called PGAs, or programmable gain amplifiers, and it's very helpful to have counters as well to, say, for example, count events. Also, there are peripherals to support actuation, and this includes D to A converters and pulse width modulated outputs that allow for fine motor control. Most MCUs also have integrated hardware peripherals for communication, particularly wired communication. The most simple of these is probably asynchronous serial communication. And this is where there is no additional clock. The clock has to be extracted from the data pattern. And this includes RS-232 as well as more advanced versions such as RS-485. Very popular is something called the synchronous peripheral interconnect. This is where a separate clock line provides for sampling the data to get the information. There's also I2C, and very popular USB, which is now in large part starting to supplant RS-232 in embedded applications. And on more advanced microcontrollers, we have Ethernet, because we want to have connectivity to the internet. And in specialized applications, such as automobiles and manufacturing, there's something called controller area network. There's also support hardware on MCUs that can aid in all these functions of sensing, actuation, and communication. The first is general purpose I/O pins that can be programmed as inputs, outputs, or both with various sorts of pull up and pull down resistors, and timers. And timers are very important because in embedded systems, we are very concerned about when things happen. In selecting the hardware or MCU for a embedded system or a sensor node, we think a lot about energy efficiency. And this comes in two different aspects, and I've shown them here. The first one is highlighted because that's what we're going to talk about first. It says here we want to ensure that every electronic component in the sensor or embedded system uses the minimum amount of energy to do its job. To do this, we want to optimize the process technologies used in developing the device. This includes digital, analog, and radio frequency. We also want to improve power regulation and management. This is primarily about efficiency. We want to use devices that have very, very high efficiency in terms of getting the power from a battery or another source to the actual MCU. We will talk about number two in a little bit. Let's take a look at an example MCU. In this case, it's the STM32 from STMicro. This is a 32-bit MCU that's based on one of the ARM cores. So let's start with the core. It's right here in the blue. It has the core and peripherals, flash, and RAM. Now, this is what's called a slave main power domain. It's actually controlled by a main supervisor, which is in the same domain as the low power control and independent watchdog. The idea here is that this section is almost always on, and it allows this section to go to sleep, in other words, turn off. Notice that we do have the ability here to wake up the MCU with an outside input so that almost the entire device can be put to sleep. Over on the right is a real-time clock and backup registers. If you want to put the core asleep, then you may want to back up the state of the system in the backup registers, as I talked about before. The advantage is that these registers have much lower leakage, and so when the device is asleep, putting the information here as opposed to here saves a lot of energy. And of course, you might want to run the real-time clock, so for example, your system could wake up every hour or so. Here is where the battery voltage comes in. There's a power switch, and this allows you to run the real-time clock on one of two power sources, either a main power source or a specific battery for the real-time clock, and this allows the real-time clock battery to last much longer. Each of these domains has a different voltage, and that is what allows ST to maximize the efficiency of the device at various levels of activity. Writing the software for MCUs in embedded systems is very difficult, and that's primarily because the tools we have don't make it very easy. So there are some tools that help us debug them, and it turns out that debugging takes the majority of the time when you're doing system development. In fact, it's probably 80% or more. So to help with debugging, there are several tools that you can use to make it easier to understand what the system is doing and when. The first is called in-circuit debugging. And if you have hardware support, usually it's in the form of what's called JTAG, which allows you to interrogate the processor to understand its state. So this would mean what the program counter is, what is in the accumulator, if it's an accumulator-based machine or in the register file, what is in memory. It's nice because it has additional hardware to support this functionality with basically no overhead on the hardware of the actual device. So the JTAG hardware sits in the background unless you need it. And finally, the thing about JTAG in-circuit debugging is that it does require custom tools. And these tools are an interface, which takes pins on the chip, as well as special software, primarily on the development platform, which normally is a PC. Before we had JTAG, people would do what's called tracing. And this is also known as logging. The first thing you do is get a serial communication up and running. And you can log activity over the serial port, say to a PC. It has a lot of flexibility, and because the debugging statements are embedded in your code, you know exactly what you have, but it does have significant overhead. And this is in terms particularly of timing, because if you have statements in your code for outputting data to a serial port, then that takes away time to do what you've actually designed the code for. And finally, we're seeing more and more of what we call power debugging. And this is where you are looking at system activity and understanding what power is being used, and more importantly, how to debug your code so that you use the minimum power necessary to accomplish what you need to do. MCUs are available from a number of manufacturers, and each manufacturer has dozens or even hundreds of particular devices to choose from. So picking an MCU for a particular application, such as a sensor node, is a daunting proposition. The first thing you would consider would be the data path width. The very, very cheapest MCUs have a 4-bit data path. That's very, very small. They're very hard to get now. The cheapest ones normally have an 8-bit data path. And to give you an idea, these devices can be bought for about a quarter in quantity. If we move up, we have the 16-bit data path and a 32-bit data path. And the 32-bit machines, instead of costing a quarter, might cost $20. So there's a huge range there. So the other thing you want to think about is what development tool chain. So by this, I mean when you write software, you need to be able to have an editor, a compiler, a linker, a downloader, and a debugger. And so understanding the capabilities of the tool chain and being able to get support is very, very important. The type of memory is very important. How much flash that you have on board will determine the complexity of your software application. You should also check and see if there's a one-time programmable or OTP version of the part for production. And also for data, if you have a data-intensive application, then you need to make sure that you have enough data RAM or SRAM. Power consumption is important. We talked on the STM32 about there was a backing store for low power sleep. Some devices have low power retention of the data in the SRAM, which is very, very nice. And you have to think about what peripherals you need and what performance of each peripheral. So a real-time clock is one, analog to digital converter is one. You need to understand what resolution in terms of number of bits, what speed and samples per second that are necessary for your application, among others. Then for actuation, there are DA converters. We've already talked about communication. And finally, different devices have different voltage requirements. And this needs to be considered in light of the entire design, because you may have peripheral devices or transducers that require a different supply voltage. Here is a hardware block diagram of an example sensor node. And the reason I want to show you this is to get at this idea of systems thinking. And one of the activities you do is to look at your design at different layers or different levels and be able to diagram or document its activity or its structure. And in this case, we have a design that includes 3 printed circuit boards. And on the left, we have the radio. In the middle, we have what's called a brain. And on the right, we have a sensor board. Now, in this design, we have 2 MCUs, one in the brain and one in the sensor board. So this way, the sensor board can take care of all the analog I/O with transducers. And here we've listed some of the transducers. There's a light transducer, temperature, general purpose, etc., etc. This is controlled by the brain, which uses a different, more capable microcontroller. The brain also has some external memory. It has external SRAM in this case, external flash, and external FRAM. The brain, of course, controls the activity of the sensor, and one of those activities is communication, and therefore it also has a connection to the radio board where the radio transceiver is. I'll mention one more thing here, and that's power management. That's becoming very, very important. In this design, we have internal battery power and also the possibility of external power, and therefore we have some circuitry that allows for automatic switching to whichever has the highest supply voltage.